Hi, this is Alan Ruff, the Thursday host of A Public Affair. If you have a moment and the resources, remember to support the station. And if you will, head over to WRTFM.org to donate and to see what else is going on at the station.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from
under. And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. So how do we begin to understand the simultaneous crises in Haiti and Cuba? Is the unrest in both countries merely coincidental? Or might we draw from some longer view of history to suggest other vantage points and ways of seeing? What does the longer story of ceaseless U.S. meddling in the region suggest? What could it mean now as elements in Havana and Port-au-Prince, Miami and Washington reflexively call for stepped up, increased U.S. intervention? With us today to hopefully help us gain some perspective on the current moment is Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn is professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. He's the author of nearly 40 books, focusing primarily on revolution and counter-revolution, black liberation and self-determination, and struggles against colonialism, imperialism, and war. In recent years, he's published, among other titles, Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, Confronting Black Jacobin, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, and White Supremacy Confronted, a work on South Africa, which we'll be getting to as well today. Dr. Horn, welcome back to WORT.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's jump right in. Gerald Horn, from your vantage point with its longer historical perspective, what do you see? What do you glean from the events of the past week? What messages are you drawing from the dual crises in Haiti and Cuba and how they're being portrayed?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to see these dual crises, as you put it, as in part a product of the after effects of revolution. That is to say, counter-revolution, in fact. We all know, I'm sure, that the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, was an event of world historic proportion. It ignited a general crisis of the entire slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse, not least in the United States of America by 1865. It was the Haitian Revolution that convinced London that the jig was up with regard to the centuries-long slave trade, which it moved away from in 1807, and then moved away from slavery itself and its cash cows of Jamaica, Barbados, etc., by 1833, 1834. However, the slaveholders' republic, speaking of the United States of America, dug in its heels. It became a major vector of opposition to the Haitian Revolution, helping to ignite the splitting of the island that we refer to as Hispaniola. If you look at your map, you may find it curious that on this one Caribbean island, you have two countries, Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And the fact that that island was split is due in no small measure to what happens in 1844 and one of the signal successes of so-called U.S. covert action. The United States helps to split the island in two, leading to not only the creation of the Dominican Republic, but a round robin of conflict between the two neighbors, which to a degree continues to this very day. I'm sure your listeners know about the U.S. occupation of Haiti for almost 20 years, beginning in 1915. I'm sure your listeners may have followed the continued intervention in the internal affairs of Haiti, not only during the Duvalier maladministration of some decades ago, culminating with the ouster of so-called baby Doc Duvalier in 1986, but it also bleeds into the Cuban Revolution, because with the triumph of the Cuban Revolution in 1959, you saw another igniting of counter-revolution, with the United States becoming the main vector of opposition to Havana, up to and including the so-called Bay of Pigs debacle of 1961, when the United States sponsored a counter-revolutionary invasion of Cuba. But also one of the reasons for United States support for the Duvaliers was because of his proximity, Haiti's proximity to Cuba. And the point was that Haiti would become a kind of beachhead against Cuba, that also, from Washington's point of view, had the so-called benefit of helping to squash internal left-wing opposition within Haiti. I'm speaking of the fact that you had a Haitian Communist Party organized in the 1930s under the leadership of one of this hemisphere's greatest intellectuals, speaking of Jacques Rouman, R-O-U-M-A-N. Those who are not familiar with him should at least peruse his translated master novel, Masters of the Dew. Interestingly enough, that is the title. And with the rise of the Duvaliers and the rise of the Cuban Revolution simultaneously, you had the squashing of progressive and radical movements in Haiti, which obviously creates an ideological vacuum that then opens the door to the kind of right-leaning dictatorships that you've seen, and the ouster of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who in a sense tried to break that mold. But as you may recall, he was ousted too in this century, in fact, and you may recall how he was deposited by the U.S. authorities in the Central African Republic, in the middle of Africa, before he made his way to South Africa. And of course, speaking of South Africa, that also raises the question of the connection between South Africa and Cuba, because it was the Cuban military forces that defeated the apartheid army on the battlefield, that turned the tide against apartheid and made them more susceptible to sweet reason and negotiating their turning over power finally in 1994. But that was both an asset and a liability, because the heavy lifting was done by the Cuban forces, who then, of course, went home. But this happens in the context of the collapse of the Soviet Union, which had been a major force in favor of the Cuban Revolution, and also had been a major funder of the African National Congress and its armed wing in Komto Wesizwe. And it's no accident, as I say in my book, that the apartheid authorities choose to negotiate with the ANC after the Berlin Wall collapses in November 1989. And so the ANC inherited very powerful forces amongst the so-called white minority that were backed by Washington, whereas the ANC's patron had collapsed. Then that was compounded by mistakes on the part of the ANC leadership, not least putting Jacob Zuma into power as a result of an internal coup against Mandela's successor, speaking of Thabo Mbeki. That happened about a decade or so ago. And I understand why this took place to a degree, because there was this perception that the Zulus were underrepresented in the top ranks of the ANC and the government. Jacob Zuma happens to be Zulu, and that was a feather in his cap. But the problem is that once he got into power, he has been charged credibly during his nearly 10-year reign of looting the treasury along with his cronies of about $500 billion, believe it or not, which then led to this inquiry, the Zondo Commission, which was investigating corruption. Mr. Zuma failed to show up for the hearings. He was charged with contempt of court and then was jailed, and that led to this unrest, which was triggered by his jailing. But it's fair to say that inequality and poverty were the underlying causes of this unrest. Just like you could talk about Los Angeles, August 1965, the arrest of Marquette Frye by the authorities being the trigger, but the underlying causes of the Watts Revolt of August 1965 were poverty, homelessness, and all the rest, not to mention white supremacy and racism. So what we see now, quite frankly, I'm afraid to say, as this unrest continues as we speak in South Africa, is a major challenge to the African National Congress and its partners in the ruling alliance, speaking of the South African Communist Party and the Congress of South African Trade Unions. And right now, the situation, I'm afraid to say, is rather dicey, but that is a kind of connective thread that ties together Haiti, Cuba, and South Africa, and the simultaneous unrest that's erupting in all three places. And of course, I would be remiss if I failed to mention how under the 45th U.S. president, sanctions against Cuba were ratcheted up, particularly in terms of curbing remittances, that is to say, money flowing from Cuban Americans into the island itself. Then, of course, COVID, which has had a negative impact on South Africa and Haiti, too, also had a devastating impact on Cuba in terms of curbing tourism, which became a major source of revenue in the aftermath of A, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then B, after the squeezing of Venezuela, which had also become a partner of Havana. But with COVID, tourism was squeezed, and there you have it.
You're listening to Professor Gerald Horn from the historian at the University of Houston, author of numerous titles. We're talking about Haiti, Cuba, South Africa, the commonalities, the common threads, revolution and counter-revolution. We'll be opening up the phone lines at, half past the hour at 608-256-2001. If you want to join with a question, a comment, an observation, again, give us a call at 608-256-2001 at about half past the hour. Gerald Horn, I want to return to some earlier history that we buzzed by. That is the U.S. Marine invasion of Haiti in 1915 under President Woodrow Wilson. Interestingly, I found, looking back, that it came on the heels of the then Haitian president's assassination. That became, in a sense, a pretext. And you talked about, just now you used the term, looting the treasury in regard to South Africa, what's been going on there. I've always found it interesting that the Marines actually went and emptied the National Bank of Haiti of its gold stock and so on, and shipped it to New York, and it's, in a sense, never stopped. Talk about that legacy, particularly they come in 1915 and they're there until what, into the 30s?
That is correct, 1934. And it's not only that intervention that characterizes that tumultuous era. Recall that 1910 to 1920 is the Mexican Revolutionary decade. And recall that U.S. forces also intervened forcefully in Mexico in a failed search to trap and ensnare the hero Pancho Villa. Recall as well that there was an intervention simultaneously in the Dominican Republic. Recall as well that it was during that same period that U.S. imperialism and colonialism took over the Virgin Islands, which it still controls, from the declining Danish Empire in Copenhagen. But I should also try to connect some of this tumult and some of these events to what's going on in the United States of America, because you may recall that I began talking about the negative response in the United States to the Haitian Revolution, the Slaveholders' Republic. I say on the first page of my book about the Haitian Revolution under the then first U.S. President George Washington, when he was apprised of the tumult of August 1791, he could foresee what was about to unfold, and his hair almost simultaneously was lit on fire. The hysteria in his brain was so intense. And that allows me to pivot and talk about a contemporary issue in the United States of America. That is to say that much ado has been made about not just the 1619 project of the New York Times with this architect, Nicole Hannah-Jones, inaugurated in August 2019, but also her controversial assertion that slavery was a factor that drove the revolt against British rule in 1776. Now, what's interesting about that is that you have a number of mainstream historians, a number, I'm afraid to say, and I can mention their names if you're interested, who have ties to your August University in Wisconsin, where you're sitting. And they act as if connecting slavery and the founding is almost like saying men from Mars were involved in the founding. But what's interesting is that last week in the Financial Times of London, Simon Schama, S-C-H-M-A, one of the most celebrated intellectuals and scholars in the North Atlantic corridor. He's an endowed professor at Columbia, writes for the Financial Times on a regular basis. He had a column where he referred all who had forgotten to his book, Rough Crossing, where he basically says the same thing about slavery being a factor in the founding. On July 4th, 2021, Woody Holton, one of the most celebrated historians of that period, happens to be the son of a governor, a late governor of Virginia, the brother-in-law of Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia. He was given 2 pages in the Washington Post to say the same thing. And so as I'm reading this, and thinking about the attacks on Nicole Hannah-Jones, who, of course, had a controversy about getting tenure at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, it reminded me that in some ways, Black people in the United States were treated like a colonized people, just like Haitians and Cubans and even South Africans are not allowed self-determination. That's part of the process of being colonized. And just as France can have a major state sector and that passes muster in Washington. But if Nicaragua tries to have a major state sector, that leads to sabotage, counter-revolution, mining the harbors, et cetera. And so if Black people in the United States want to point out that slavery was a factor in the founding, all hell breaks loose. But if you're not Black, like Simon Schama or Woody Holton, with these impeccable ruling class credentials, you can be accorded real estate in the most prestigious newspapers, the Financial Times and the Washington Post, to say as much. Now, somebody needs to explain to me some other explanation as to why this difference, other than naked racism and treating Black people like they're colonized.
Again, you're listening to historian Gerald Horn talking about, well, revolution and counter-revolution. In the Caribbean, the Western Hemisphere, global, and what appears to be, to me anyway, a kind of reactionary offensive at present that is global in its breadth. 256-0825-6-2001. You can join us again in a few minutes. We'll be opening up the phone lines. Again, 608-256-2001. So, Gerald Horn, what do you make of people calling for U.S. intervention in both instances? I think they're usually talking about direct military intervention because, well, in actuality, when has the United States ever stopped intervening?
Well, the mayor of Miami went on Fox News the other day and called for U.S. military intervention in Cuba. It's also interesting that the Florida legislature in Tallahassee basically provoked, shall we say, by Black Lives Matter protests, passed this law, so-called anti-riot law, that subjects those who block highways and freeways to severe penalties. They were assuming.
Oh, do we lose?
See, communist protesters in Miami blocked passageways, of course. They were treated daintily and with utter politeness, once again unveiling and revealing the naked double standards that are used against protesters from the right as opposed to progressive protesters. We should all draw reasonable inferences from this double standard. But interestingly enough, there's also have been muted calls for U.S. intervention in Haiti as well, despite the fact that the United Nations intervention sponsored by the United States led to an epidemic of cholera from UN troops that killed thousands in Haiti, not to mention a kind of sexual terrorism that is still reverberating on the island island of Haiti. And so obviously that would be a terrible idea, speaking of U.S. intervention. And it's remarkable that any folks could form their mouth and lips to utter such inanities about U.S. military intervention in Haiti. And certainly it contravenes the idea of Haitian solutions for Haitian problems. But alas, we already know, at least preliminarily, that the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, the slain Haitian president, I'm afraid to say, has some U.S. fingerprints on it, insofar as a chief suspect is a doctor of Haitian origin who, interestingly enough, resides in Florida, not to mention the fact that some of those who are accused apparently had worked as informants for the Drug Enforcement Administration of the United States and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You may recall that when the apparent assassins turned up at the residence of Mr. Moïse, that they claimed that they were DEA agents, Drug Enforcement Administration agents. And it is rather curious that Mr. Moïse was slain, his wife was injured, but our sources in Haiti tell us that the president usually is guarded by a retinue of 100 or more palace guards. None of them were injured, interestingly enough. And of course, the head of the palace guard has just been taken into custody. Of course, rather curiously, he had traveled to Colombia in the weeks preceding the assassination, and those who have been fingered and detained thus far are mostly of Colombian origin, which also is interesting because we know that Colombia has a well-merited reputation for generating mercenaries based upon the fact that for decades now, there has been an off and on internal conflict between guerrilla forces and the Colombian military. And therefore, the military is well-trained in terms of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and they've been dispatched to the four corners of the globe to provide so-called security in various circumstances. So obviously, we need a thorough investigation of what role the United States may have played in this tragic development that is still unfolding as we speak on the island we oftentimes refer to as Hispaniola.
Now, of course, what I found interesting in regard to what you were just running through was almost immediately people from the National Security Council in the U.S., Homeland Security, the State Department, and the FBI were immediately dispatched to meet with Haiti's interim leaders, so-called, and the National Police. So it's pretty direct, I think, the whole operation. We'll find out, I'm sure we'll find out more. Also reported today, I found interesting, this was an AP dispatch I came across as I was preparing for this program, that Haiti yesterday received its first coronavirus vaccine since the pandemic began, receiving 500,000 doses from basically the U.S. through other intermediaries, coming right on the heels of this, well, at some level, certainly a regime change. Thoughts on any of that?
Well, what's interesting about Haiti is that it is also an exemplar of the kind of apartheid that is gripping this small planet in the wake of the COVID epidemic. That is to say, in certain nations, such as the United States, there's talk about a third jab by the Pfizer Pharmaceutical Corporation. Now, of course, parenthetically, I should mention that Pfizer has profited handsomely from developing this vaccine, and we have to look at this idea of a third jab with that in mind. For example, since it's all subsidized by the U.S. government, they may see this as a new cash cow. And next, we'll be talking about a fourth jab, fifth jab, on ad infinitum. But in any case, Haiti thus far has not, until this just announcement you just made, has not received any vaccines. And I'd be curious to know what is the true rate of mortality with regard to COVID in Haiti. And speaking of which, your listeners may be curious as to why the United States has paid so much attention to Haiti over the years and over the decades. Well, one is what I've already suggested. That is to say, you have those from slave-owning families in the United States whose property was wiped out altogether in 1865. That is to say, the slave owners in Britain who owned enslaved in Jamaica and Barbados, et cetera, were compensated. We know that the newly born Haitian government in the 1820s was forced to pay reparations to the enslavers in France, where there's the enslavers in the United States, except for a small group in Washington, D.C., were basically wiped out. And that is something that is hard to forgive and hard to forget, which leads to this current persecution of Haiti, which, of course, was the triggering factor and leading to the liquidation of the entire slave system. And then, once again, there's the strategic position of Haiti, not far distant from Cuba. And we all know that Cuba has been a burr under the saddle of U.S. imperialism ever since the revolution triumphed in 1959. There are those in Washington, and certainly some in South Africa itself, who will never forget, as noted, that it was the Cuban military that delivered the knockout blows to Washington's allies, speaking of apartheid South Africa. And then, of course, there's the fact that Haiti is known to be a storehouse of minerals, including gold, that because of various kinds of political instability and turmoil has not been, quote, exploited, unquote, successfully to this point. And there are ravenous vultures on Wall Street who are salivating at the prospect of descending en masse into Haiti so as to plunder these resources for their own narrow gain.
608-256-2001. We do have a caller that's been waiting patiently to get in with a question or a comment. Let's open up the phone lines. Hi, Miguel. You're on the air.
Yes. When we look at Cuba, we can see how badly they have treated the gays over the years. And, you know, those who live in socialist and communist countries, they want to come here. And then those here who want socialism and communism, they've never lived in those countries. And so they need to pull their head out of their butt.
Well, thank you, Miguel, for that comment. Actually, I've lived under Chinese administration. Last time I looked, China was ruled by the Communist Party. I was a professor at the University of Hong Kong, a special administrative region of the People's Republic of China. This was over two decades ago. Certainly, Cuba has problems. You would not have seen what you saw on Sunday without making reference to those problems. But once again, I agree with the president of Mexico, AMLO, López Obrador, who suggested that the first step to addressing whatever problems Cuba may have is lifting the blockade, which is one of the reasons why AMLO, who himself is not necessarily viewed favorably, particularly along the Texas-Mexico border, and I say this as a person who's speaking to you from Texas, it's very interesting that he offered to provide vaccines and food and other necessities to Cuba. And speaking of which, as you know, Cuba has developed its own vaccine in conjunction with the Iranians. And this points to the short-sightedness of U.S. imperialism, because if you think, if U.S. imperialism thinks that depriving Cuba of vaccines is going to help U.S. imperialism, I guess they need to speak to some virologists and vaccinologists and epidemiologists, because Cuba's only 90 miles away from the United States itself. And it's unclear to me, it's clear to me that this virus could spread easily from Cuba into South Florida. And so therefore it backfires. And so once again, speaking to use Miguel's rather colorful metaphor of having this anatomically difficult exercise in motion, it seems to me that that metaphor of having your head in your butt could easily be applied to U.S. imperialism and Wall Street.
Of course, part of the arguments that you hear from the right and the center in regard to the current moment in Cuba is that, yes, there are these various economic and social difficulties. Certainly one of them being the fact that the United States embargo is not allowing syringes needed to implement vaccinations across the island. But they argue that it's issue of human rights and or democracy, that the island has a dictatorship. But as we know, of course, that has, depending on who you're, what country you're talking about, that has not always been a problem for United States strategists and planners. If there's a long list of dictators, dictatorships, violators of human rights, et cetera, that the U.S. has had no problem with. So that gets to, of course, the issue of hypocrisy here.
Well, hypocrisy is the lubrication that keeps the engine of U.S. imperialism humming. I mean, for example, I recall, since I lived in Zimbabwe as well and continue to be in touch with trends there and did a book on Zimbabwe, in fact, that after this land reclamation project was launched about a decade ago, which targeted the farmers of European descent, many of whom had shallow roots in the country going back, say, to 1945, for example, that all hell broke loose. And I recall talking to a host on Pacifica Radio about this, and I was wondering why they were spending so much time lambasting the Zimbabwean regime, supposedly for human rights violations, when in Los Angeles, and the host was in Los Angeles, not far distant from the Pacifica studio, you had the son of the dictator of Equatorial Guinea, a country in West Africa that has millions, if not billions of dollars in U.S. oil investments. He had this palatial estate in Malibu, of all places, had one of the world's largest collections of Michael Jackson memorabilia, obvious, while the people, of course, are starving and hungry. No opposition allowed, whereas in Zimbabwe, there was an opposition press, opposition parties, represented in parliament, et cetera. So I was saying, well, why don't you all talk about Equatorial Guinea or Cameroon or some of these other human rights deserts, if you want to talk about Africa. And the host said, well, we'll get to that. Well, 10 years later, I'm still waiting. And I think what that bespeaks is that too often, even for progressive forces, U.S. imperialism sets the agenda and then they respond. So if U.S. imperialism has something bad to say about Zimbabwe, they'll have something bad to say about Zimbabwe, or they'll focus on Zimbabwe. If U.S. imperialism does say anything about Equatorial Guinea, they don't say anything about Equatorial Guinea. And if U.S. imperialism is hostile towards Cuba, they respond accordingly. What's wrong with that picture?
This brings me to think about the mainstream media network's roles in these moments. It was revealed just the other day that CNN ran a photograph of allegedly of a demonstration in Havana against the government, protest against what's going on in terms of the needs of the people. But it turned out it was actually a photograph of a demonstration in Little Havana in Miami And those with a keen eye noted the street signage in the photograph to show that it was in Miami, but CNN carried it regardless, or intentionally, one has to assume. Now, Gerald Horn, there's been a great deal of discussion currently on the left in regard to racial capitalism. In regard to the Caribbean specifically, and more broadly in regard to the global South as a whole, might we talk about a higher stage of what I was thinking might be called racial imperialism? Just touching on that, of course.
Well, sure. I mean, why not? You know, this concept of racial capitalism, I think, can be useful, although I think that if you look into the origins of capitalism itself, which I did in my book on the 16th century, you'll find that there is an inextricability between the rise of capitalism and the rise of the African slave trade. That if you look at the 16th century, speaking of the 1500s in particular, it's difficult to avoid the conclusion that what happens with regard to the Western European countries, such as London in particular, which were indispensable with regard to the rise of capitalism, is that they pivot neatly from religious conflict to racialized targeting. That is to say that after Martin Luther breaks away from the Catholic Church, circa 1517, forming what was then known as the Protestant sect, which is joined by London in the 1530s, which launches a round robin of conflict between Western European countries of the Catholic persuasion, particularly Spain, which had a first mover's advantage since it sponsored Christopher Columbus, the pirate and freebooter, which is one of the reasons why south of Texas, so many people speak Spanish in this hemisphere. And this religious conflict between Madrid and London also takes place in the Americas to the extent that Spain, in order to become a settler, you had to be Catholic. Even when Stephen F. Austin and his comrades move into what we call Texas today, about 200 years ago, they had to at least nominally profess Catholicism. Whereas London, the scrappy underdog, did not have Protestant religion as a qualifier for settlement. They moved towards race. That is to say, they reconciled with those who they'd been warring with, particularly the Irish and the Scots and the Welsh, and then expanded that to include those who had been warring on the shores of Europe, British versus German, German versus Pole, Pole versus Russian, Serb versus Croat, Northern Italian versus Southern Italian. All of a sudden, when they cross the Atlantic, they're magically re-Christian as, quote, white, unquote, in a maneuver that would make Madison Avenue blush. And then the targets of their exploitation were then racialized as capitalism was taking off, speaking of the indigenous and the Africans. And so racial capitalism, in short, I find to be a useful term, but there are those who consider that it is, in a sense, redundant, because from its inception, capitalism was racialized, just like from its inception, imperialism was racialized. And that brings me back to where we began in talking about there are populations that are racialized in North America, not least the population of African descent, who are then concomitantly and subsequently viewed not only as racialized subjects, but as colonized subjects to a degree.
608-256, we're getting well. We've got about 10 minutes left in the hour. Give us a call at 608-256-2001 if you have a question or a comment, an observation for our guest today, historian Gerald Horn. You know, Gerald, I've been to Cuba a number of times since the early 90s. And often on returning, someone always asks me to explain the ongoing animosity toward Cuba, but embedded in U.S. policy that transcends administration from, Kennedy to Biden. How do you explain that animosity? Some say, for instance, it's the Cuban vote in Miami and New Jersey, that it's just politics. But it always strikes me as something much deeper in it, if you could talk about a political psyche or political culture.
Well, as you know more than most, a secular religion of the United States for decades, and it has not necessarily dissipated with the collapse of the Soviet Union, has been anti-communism. And Cuba was and is ruled by a communist party. Not only that, but it's refused to bend a knee. It's supported the Sandinista Revolution, the Grenadian Revolution, the Hugo Chavez regime in Venezuela and its successors. It had close relations with Michael Manley's Social Democrats in Jamaica. As noted, it fought arms in hand against the apartheid regime of Pretoria, one of the United States' closest allies. It supported the Algerian Revolution, which came to power in 1962. And so Havana has repeatedly thumbed a nose at U.S. imperialism and had the gumption to do so only 90 miles from U.S. shores and only having a population today of about 12 million compared to the United States' 330 million. And then, as noted, being an ally with the former Soviet Union. And in fact, I would go so far as to say that one possible aftermath of what's happened in Cuba this week might be Cuba moving even closer to Beijing and Moscow. That is to say, even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there have been fraternal and positive relations between Russia and Cuba. After this past Sunday, the foreign ministry in Moscow issued a statement warning Washington to keep hands off of Cuba. I expect that Cuba's relations with China will also accelerate, because keep in mind that Cuba's relations with China were not always positive. I'm sure I don't have to recount the story about how China got into the passing lane with this deal with Nixon and Kissinger in the early 1970s, with the payoff being massive foreign direct investment, which has now created this juggernaut in China, which bids fair to leave U.S. imperialism sprawling in the dust. But in return, China waged war on Vietnam. In the wars in Southern Africa, as I say in my book, it was oftentimes allied with U.S. imperialism. And if you go back and look at Fidel's speech to the Non-Aligned Movement meeting in Havana about four decades ago, you'll see that he spared no words in critiquing Chinese policy. And then, of course, China waged war against Cuba's allies, speaking of Vietnam, post-1975 and the U.S. eviction. However, I think that going forward, whatever reservations that Cuba might have had about China, and keep in mind that China, as we speak, is a major trade partner of Cuba, despite these past tensions and contradictions, that I expect Chinese aid to accelerate. And one has to wonder if that is in the best interest of U.S. imperialism.
Gerald Hunt, actually, Rochelle just sent me a note saying that we had a question from a listener via Facebook. Michael asks, weren't the U.S. Virgin Islands acquired from Denmark, by purchase and not intervention?
Oh, well, quote, yes, by purchase. Yes, quote unquote, yes.
Well, thanks. We have a couple minutes left anyway. One of the things that's fascinated me recently, and actually for quite some time, is Cuba's medical internationalism. My guest last week, who talked about the embargo of syringes to Cuba, mentioned that Cuba currently has, or in this past year, in the pandemic year, has dispatched 6,000 doctors and medical aid personnel to 40 countries, largely, of course, but not exclusively, in the global South. And the Cubans have said, well, we cannot compete with the U.S. In terms of arms and weapons and so on, but they have this internationalist medical program going. They even bring, you know, students from low-income inner cities and so on here in the United States to study at the medical school in Havana, free of charge, of course. Always fascinating to me.
Well, not only that, but there are a number of U.S. students who go and study medicine in Cuba. I recall looking at the Final Call newspaper, the newspaper of the Nation of Islam, some months ago, and some of the descendants, I think they were grandchildren or something of that character, of the head of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, were studying medicine in Cuba. And I should also say, as in the interest of full disclosure, that if you were able to look at my will, which will disperse my sparse assets once I'm 6 feet under, you will find that a significant portion will go to that medical school in Havana, which trains medics for dispatching to the Caribbean, to Africa, to Latin America, etc. And I think that this bespeaks the internationalism of the Cuban Revolution. And I would hope that those who stormed into the streets in Cuba on Sunday recognize that if somehow, by some stroke of fate, the Communist Party were to be toppled, they should not expect to keep the benefits of socialism and then having the blockade ease. As a matter of fact, the situation will probably get worse than it is now. And any benefits such as free education and even benefits that people in Canada have compared to the United States. That's what gets me about these people in the United States. Supposedly you have this grand revolution in 1776, then you have this control group across the border in Canada, which did not have a revolt against British rule, although it was invited to do so. And yet, here in Canada, in terms of the first obligation of the state, you have a single-payer healthcare system, as opposed to this pay-or-die system in the so-called Revolutionary Republic. And yet, these historians, to use Miguel's phrase, who engage in this anatomically difficult exercise of keeping your head in your posterior, don't even bother to ask, for the most part, why that is. Instead, they continue to sing about the tattered glories of 1776 and the slaveholding republic that eventuated, which then morphed into U.S. imperialism.
Got just a couple minutes left, Gerald Horn. What do you have coming out soon? You seem to, sometimes twice a year, I don't know how you do it, but what projects are you working on now? What do you have forthcoming?
Well, I should mention my latest books, The Bittersweet Sure. Science, Racism, Racketeering, the Political Economy of Boxing, and the book on the 16th century, which I made reference to during our conversation, The Dawning of the Apocalypse. Now, I've been working on this book on Texas, Mexico, but the archives have been shut down. So I'm about 95% finished, but I need to make one last trip to the National Archives in College Park, which has been closed for more than a year now. They're in real lockdown. They're in Hermit Kingdom lockdown. You can't even get them to respond to phone calls. So I don't know when they'll reopen. And that's true for most archives, believe it or not, which I'm sure people in your history department in Madison could speak about at length.
Tell us a little bit. I'm curious, and I want to have you on, hopefully not too distant future, to talk about your book on boxing. Talk about that a moment. It's in some sense a departure from your previous work, but also as part of a continuity.
Well, yes, part of a continuity, because, you know, I did a book on jazz, I did two books on Hollywood, and so I have this interest in popular culture. And then boxing, I deal a lot with the fact of trying to explicate how and why it is that so many folks of African descent have done well in boxing, and I trace it all the way back to fighting the slaver and slavers on the shores of Africa, the development of African martial arts, which you can go on YouTube and see in terms of capoeira in Brazil, and also the battle royal, which was a favorite of enslavers in this country, whereby they put 9 or 10 young black men in a ring and blindfold them and have them go at each other, and whoever emerged triumphant would get a prize. And you'll find that some of the early, and the battle royal continued post-slavery. And so if you look at, say, Bo Jack, who was a leading welterweight in the 1940s and the early 1950s, he comes out of the battle royals of Augusta, GA, which happens to be the home, as you know, of James Brown. So I try to look at the material aspects of why black Americans have done so well in boxing, steering away from this pseudoscience of, you know, looking at their calves and their genes and all of this other nonsense. And I'm also looking at racketeering, organized crime, because like many aspects of popular culture, not least music, boxing has been dominated by organized crime, including comrades, I might say, of the 45th U.S. president, who, as you know, was a kind of casino mogul in Atlantic City, which sponsored more than one boxing match under his aegis.
Well, unfortunately, Gerald Horn, I have to let you go today. We'll get you back on somewhere not too far down the road. I want to thank you very much. You've been listening to Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. We've been talking primarily today about the dual crises in Haiti and Cuba, branched off into South Africa and so on, and some longer history. Two books, Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, and Confronting Black Jacobin, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, in his book on South Africa, White Supremacy Confronted. I want to thank Rochelle. I want to thank our caller, our listeners. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week. Thank you, Gerald Horn.
Thank you. Above sea level, I grab the mic.